So we continue our study in the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, and just a reminder that this is a love poem that is dealing with this maiden and Solomon, the king of Israel, and it's just this fantastic love story told in a poem form. And as I've been mentioning, you know, poems are not always the easiest thing to understand. Even modern day poems, when you read them, they're full of images and symbols, and sometimes even the way the constructions are, it takes a few readings to fully understand what the poet is actually saying. Then when you add the fact that this was written in Hebrew over 2,000 years ago, it even becomes more critical that we remember that it is a poem about a love story, and sometimes we just need to kind of step back and kind of take a look at it. Now, what has been my habit so far for the first few chapters is that I've been reading through the passage and kind of commenting on what it's saying, and then kind of wrapping it up at the end. But this morning, I'm going to do it a little bit different. I'm going to just read straight through the passage that we're going to really focus on this morning, because I want you to hear this, the passion of Solomon. Here it's Solomon talking about this maiden that he's about to marry, how he feels about her. And I just think it's important that we just kind of go through that. And then after we do that, I'll go back through the passage. So if you have your Bibles, open up to the Song of Songs, chapter 4. I'll be reading out in NIV. But most of the translations are very similar. And of course, the words will be up here on the screen. So remember, this is Solomon. He is talking toward to his bride. They're about to be married. And he says this: "How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veils are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from the hills of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn, coming from the washing. Each has its twin, not one of them is alone. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with courses of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. You are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amman, from the top of Senir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's den and the mountain haunts of leopards. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume more than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon." So here he is actually talking about his love. He is explaining how he feels about her. He is thinking about her beauty. And you know, as we think about her, and just, you know, to him, she's the most beautiful woman on the planet. And I just want to share, I'm going to share something, and I'm a little reluctant because I don't want to objectify her. I don't want to show something that's so risque that maybe you might get upset, and I don't want to unleash any man's passion. But there is a picture that I would like to show you of this amazing woman. And this is what she looks like. Craig, would you go ahead and advance it? There she is. Isn't she beautiful? Her nose is like the Tower of David. Her hair is like goats descending down from Mount Gilead. Her teeth are like sheep just shorn coming up from the washing. Her lips are like scarlet. Her temples are like pomegranates. Her breasts are like fawns. She's altogether beautiful. Isn't that just beautiful? So, you know, this is why we do not take the Song of Solomon literally in everything that it says. You know, when we talk about the Bible, we talk about Cooper's Golden Rule, which is, when plain sense make common sense, seek no other sense. So, you know, when we're talking about his description of her, this isn't really what she looked like. So you just want to be aware of that. So what is he saying in this amazing fourth chapter? Well, let's look at it again. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. So he's already laying down the groundwork. Here he is. He's the king. He could have any woman that he wants. He is surrounded by all the women who have been primped and cared for and try to catch his eye. He is around women who are that time and that place, the most beautiful women in the world and what people consider to be beautiful. But yet it's this maiden, this girl that works out in the vineyards that has captured his heart. And he says, you're the one that's beautiful. You're the one that I love. And he says, first of all, your eyes behind your veil are doves. And it carries that sense of being gentle and tender. There may be some implication of the cooing sound, kind of that enticing, where her eyes communicate to him. And the veil is something that would be worn to not only hide the face, not maybe hide her beauty, but also to enhance her beauty. And then he talks about her hair is like a flock of goats descending from the hills of Gilead. So basically he's saying that her hair is flowing down over her shoulders. Just the whole idea of these goats coming down, and he just says, they're just beautiful. Your hair is beautiful. It comes down and across your shoulders and just kind of flows down your back. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn. Coming up from the washing. Now, this kind of sounds odd, but basically, you know what he's saying is? And he says, each has its twin, not one of them is alone. He's basically saying, you have some of the whitest teeth I've ever seen. And you have all of them. I know today that just sounds like, well, duh, but in this day, they didn't have all their teeth. If you read American history and you go back, I mean, George Washington didn't have his teeth. John Adams struggled with losing his teeth. People didn't have all their teeth. And the idea of also coming up from the washing carries the idea that she takes care of herself. You know, that she has a vitality. That she has a vigor and a purity. Your lips are like scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. Right? He doesn't just say, well, you know, you really have nice coloring. He actually is thinking through what she looks like and trying to imagine. Your lips are beautiful. You have this, your mouth and your cheeks are red with this wonderful color that's so enticing, so beautiful. And he's actually taken time to think through what he is saying to her. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with courses of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. So he's using military terms here. He's talking about the Tower of David, which in that time they would have looked at the Tower of David as something very statuesque. It was just something just to marvel and to behold and to wonder at. So she's looking at her as statuesque in her presence. And it causes a feeling of admiration and wonder. But not only that, and by the way, he is not saying your neck is really like a giraffe. It's so big it looks like a tower. You know, it is about this whole that she just holds herself regally. And as with the shields of warriors, it points to her strength, an unassailable strength that no man can conquer her. And Solomon is awed by her dignity that she carries, recognizing that her love isn't something that is a plunder to be taken, but it is something that could never be plundered. It is something that she freely gives. Your breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies until the day breaks and the shadows flee. I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. Basically, he's talking about her tenderness and that he seeks to enjoy just being with her and enjoying her pleasure. And then he says, "You are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no flaw in you." She is perfect to him. He sees her as just his perfect bride. And here is where the poem takes a slight turn, a slight break. So here he's talking about her beauty. Now he is calling her to himself in verse 8. "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amana, from the top of Senir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's den and the mountain haunts of leopards." He does see her as unassailable. Look where, you know, he sees her kind of from a, you know, that she's somebody that's almost a little bit out of reach for him. She is surrounded by lions and leopards. You know, you can't just go to her. And so he is looking at this, and even though he is the king of Israel, he is the wisest man on earth, he is feeling that she may be a little bit out of his league. That he is unable to attain her. And there's some real humility there as he's thinking, "Wow, you're so amazing and so beautiful, and you've picked me, you love me. Isn't that just amazing?" And in verse 9 it says, "You have stolen my heart." Basically, he's saying, "I am hopelessly, passionately in love with you." And his passions have been aroused. "You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes." Now, just let me take a little pause. The whole thing when he says "my sister," it's not his sister. You know, it's just a phrasing of endearment, a playful banter that they did at this time in Israel. "You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes." There's that, you know, that communicating of the eyes, playfulness of the eyes, "with one jewel of your necklace." He didn't even have to see her entire face. He didn't even have to see all of her beauty. He was captivated by her. "How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume more than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue." He desires her to lavish on him her love. "The fragrance of your garments, like the fragrance of Lebanon. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain, So again, there's this idea that she's closed off. She has to open herself to him. Even though he's the king, he's recognizing she has to, she's no trophy. You're a garden locked up. My sister, my bride, you are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard. Nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You are a garden of fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. He's recognizing that she is such an amazing person. Her personality, her pleasures that she offers, everything about her is so varied that he will never grow tired of her. He will never grow weary of her. He will never become bored with her. And now he is inviting her to consummate their marriage. And she responds, "Awake, north wind, and come, south wind. Blow on my garden, that its fragrance may spread, that its fragrance may spread everywhere. Let my beloved come into his garden and taste its choice fruit." And so here we see her inviting him to consummate their marriage. Isn't that just a wonderful chapter? Beautiful. Just stuck there in a book that we probably didn't, a lot of times most people don't even pay any attention to, because you read and you go, I don't know, it's a little weird. Why is this in the Bible? And how do we react to this, and what do we learn? It's kind of funny, as I've been reading this and going, I just finished one book and I'm starting another, and I'm in the process of one book. And I want to talk about these books, and you're going to think, so why are we talking about these two books? Well, I'll tell you why we're going to talk about these two books. One is called the Medici Effect. The Medici Effect is by Franz Johansson. It's an excellent book, and really for younger people, about creativity and innovation and really thinking outside the box. This is a great book. Now, I'll have to tell you, there's a couple illustrations in there that he uses on a number of occasions that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, but the overall arch of the book, really nice. And he talks about that there's our intersections of things that come into play in our lives, and that some of the greatest intersections that we discover things is because one discipline of another in our studies crisscross. And is that those points of intersection that are interesting. And that we go, aha, look at that. That's how some of the greatest discoveries have been made. Then there's another book that's very practical. It's called The Ideal Team Player. It's by Patrick Lencioni. He's one of my favorite writers, the secular writer, so sometimes the language in there can get a little rough. But he talks about who the ideal team player is. So as I was thinking about, and I know you're thinking, okay, where are we going with this? When I was thinking about Song of Songs, especially chapter 4, I kept thinking about this ideal team player book. And because in the ideal team player, he talks about three things that you look for in an ideal team player. So this is just kind of a bonus lesson this morning. The first thing is humility, that the person has to be humble. That they don't come in thinking that they're everything and that they're here to save the company, basically. So they need to have some sort of humility about them. But they also need to be hungry. And the idea of being hungry is they're not going to be just kind of lax and sitting around and doing the bare minimum. They actually are kind of wanting to get out and take on as much responsibility as they can, without being too crazy, but they're hungry. They want to see success. They want to see the company succeed. So there's this hunger that's within them. So they talk about, you look for this humility, but you also look for this desire to do something. Now, you want to be careful with this, because if they're too hungry, they could be a train wreck. They'll just kind of go everywhere. And if they're not humble, they're just going to kind of run right over people. The other thing that he talks about is that they need to be smart. And he really talks about emotionally smart, emotionally mature, but basically we would call it people smarts. that they know how to deal with people. They know how to talk to them. They're sensitive to their feelings. Now, if they're not humble and they're not so hungry, or maybe they're a little bit hungry, they could be political and really try to manipulate people. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to get that combination here where they're humble, they want to serve, they want to do the best for others, but they also want to see success. But in that whole thing, they recognize that they need to consider the feelings and the sensibilities, the sensibilities of those around them, which is very important. So with that in mind, I was thinking, well, you know, if we were going to talk about the ideal true love, there's some similarities here. So if there is an ideal true love, I think we see it really clearly in this passage. And we do start off with humility. Because in this passage, as Solomon is talking to her and asking her to come down from the hills of Lebanon where the lions are and the panthers are, he is actually expressing that she's a little bit unattainable. She's a little bit out of his league. He is the king of Israel. But yet he is so overwhelmed with who she is and her beauty and her presence that there's a humility there. And that he's not just demanding that she comes. He's not pulling some sort of sovereign royal decree that you must do this, which, to be really honest, he could have done that. But he didn't. So really, when we have a true love, especially with the younger folks that are looking and they're starting to date and look towards who might be their future mate, there needs to be this humility that they don't think they're all that. And listen, that's a lot of times it's not too hard to find people who are not humble. You just go and, I mean, the way they enter a room, the way that they present themselves, maybe the way they talk about themselves, it's always about them. They're self-serving. When I'm at the gym, and I'm working out, I have to tell you, I laugh a lot of times because I watch some of these young guys in front of the mirrors. Women don't spend as much time in front of mirrors than guys do. Well, at least not at the gym. And the other day, there's a guy, really nice-looking guy, very strong, very buff. He walks up to the mirror and he goes, and it looked like he was going through a whole routine. I'm just watching him. It's like, that just fascinates me. Look at that. Then he turns around and sees me and he just, I don't know, maybe he's practicing asking somebody out, but it was really kind of funny. But you watch them, it's kind of interesting, to see them, constantly flexing and doing their poses, and I'm like, okay, guys, move along. Maybe we should put some those carnival mirrors in there just to freak them out a little bit. Instead of the word hungry, I think passionate is a good word. Because you certainly see this passion. Everything that he's saying, he's just passionate about who she is. And he's anticipating, he's excited. He talks in these wonderful terms about her kisses are like honey. That she has stolen his heart just with the glance of her eyes. So there needs to be that passion, that love, but there also needs to be a positive, they need also be positive and affirming. Spouse smart. So they need to be positive and affirming, and that's what he's doing. He doesn't say, you look very nice today. He actually explains how she looks nice. He's affirming to her that she has choices in the matter. Please, I want you to come to me, but that's your choice. Shocking thing in this period of time, the king is looking at her as an equal. and somebody who is to be respected and loved. And that is what an ideal true love is. Not putting you down, you know, in front of your friends, not you know, setting aside, you know, or trying to make you look worse in somebody else's eyes. There's a desire to be with each other, and there's a humility that you want to serve one another. And that should pass through all of our adult lives. I saw this cartoon this week. It says this. Husband and wife are looking at each other, and he goes, "Honey, our duty is to keep reminding each other how beautiful and special we are. Okay?" And her response is, "Yes, but your job is much easier than mine." So there's a little bit of a disconnect about what you're supposed to be doing here. But it is our duty to keep reminding each other in our marriages and in our homes and those around us about how special that we are. And in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 32, it grows out of our relationship with Jesus Christ. And it doesn't mean ignoring, you know, things that need to be dealt with, but it's how we deal with it. Look at this. Be kind and compassionate to one another. So there should be a kindness, a compassion, or passion that we have with those that are within the sphere of our influence. Forgiving each other, which tells us that there are going to be times that somebody's going to mess up. Our spouse will mess up, our children will mess up, our coworkers will mess up, and even time to time we mess up. And we need to be able to offer forgiveness, and sometimes it's almost harder to receive it. But when somebody seeks it, we should certainly grant it. Because that is what we received in Christ when God forgave us. He demonstrated his kindness and his compassion for us by sending his son Christ to die for us. And that when we recognize that and ask for that forgiveness through the blood of Jesus Christ, that he forgives us. And so everything that we have, that humility, that compassion, passion, that people smarts, should always grow out of that relationship, and that it should come across with that kindness and compassion.